It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, a chef talks to us about seasonal eating, how we can get started, and some of the great things we can cook with now and in the months to come. First, the shopping mall started off as a uniquely American institution. You might have spent some of your childhood there. Cue a 1980s mall commercial.
Bayshore Mall has something special in your mailbox. 20% off coupons that you can redeem at any participating store Thursday through Sunday. The beat goes on with savings, fashion, food, and fun. Catch the beat,
it's a mall commercial from back in 1988. In some ways, the heyday of shopping malls. But malls faded in popularity over the years. There were too many of them. Big box stores added competition. Then internet shopping and the pandemic came along. But hold on. Our next guest says malls aren't dead. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you spend a lot of time in malls maybe during your childhood? Do you shop in them a lot in your adulthood? Do you have a story about a memorable time you had shopping or working at a mall? Is there a future for them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexandra Lang is a design critic. Her writing's been published in places including Harvard Design Magazine, The New York Times, and The Atlantic. Her new book is called Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. Alexandra, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I love that ad.
Now, you and I are roughly the same age. I won't reveal it to people, but I was a kid. I was a teenager in an era where going to the mall was just a thing you would do, not to buy anything necessarily. It was an attraction, and that was part of your growing up too.
Yeah, definitely. I grew up in North Carolina, and what did you do when you wanted to meet your friends on a weekend afternoon? You went to the mall. Like, maybe you went to the movies, maybe you went to the food court, maybe you just walked around and looked at things, but that was the place to go. And I think that was true for basically millions of kids, especially those who grew up in the 80s and 90s.
Now, your book isn't just a trip through nostalgia, though. What led you to decide to study malls from, a design critic standpoint?
Well, I had read a lot of the stories about the death of the mall. But at the same time, I read other stories talking about, pretty famous architects like Renzo Piano designing new retail structures that seemed to me to be a mall. They weren't calling them malls, but they were definitely malls. And I wanted to delve into the history of shopping centers and malls and figure out why they were so popular and what was still good about them.
Now, there's one key figure, an immigrant design person responsible for the mall in its modern form, Victor Gruen. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it right. Can you tell us a bit about his role in the creation of what we think of as the mall?
Sure. It's Victor Gruen. That's right. He is really the father of the shopping mall. He was a Jewish emigre from Vienna. He fled the Nazis in 1938 and came to America. And he was somebody who started designing department stores and quickly realized that the new suburbs needed a place for people to go. They needed a new downtown. And the way that they were being built, there was no main street. And he thought, what if we can get the department store owners to move from downtown to these suburban areas and build a whole main street around their store? And the first shopping mall was built in Edina, Minnesota in 1956, and that's Southdale. And it basically has this central court that has climate control, it has daylighting, and it has a little Viennese-style cafe off to the side because he thought that's what Americans needed.
The idea was that, hey, this is in some ways a public space, but protected from the weather, accessible to people in this area. Talk about Victor Gruen's vision for what he hoped the mall would be.
Yeah, I mean, Southdale, some of the initial advertising trumpeted the fact that there would be 365 shopping days a year, because you know this in Wisconsin too. In the winter, nobody wants to go shopping outdoors. So the mall provided indoor year-round shopping, and it was also supposed to serve as kind of a community gathering space. Those initial malls especially often had sculpture. They had a carousel for the kids. They had cafes, and they basically had stores that would serve all of the needs of what was often the mother living in the suburbs who had to do a bunch of errands with kids tagging along. But he also felt like they should have a public role. Some of those early models had community rooms or churches, and people, in his view, just needed a place to come together.
You write that part of the appeal of malls in these suburban areas was it was a place where you wouldn't run into poor people on the streets. You wouldn't worry about the crime, say, in a downtown area. And in many suburbs with restrictive zoning laws, you wouldn't run into black people at a mall. This was not all a happy thing in some ways.
Right. That is definitely true. Malls are in some ways a manifestation of white flight from central cities. And many of the neighborhoods around the malls would have restrictions on who could buy the housing. So even if the malls weren't specifically designated as a white space, they would have been a white space because only white people lived around them. And because they are, in fact, private property, they could be regulated, maintained, et cetera, to kind of a higher standard and a more restricted standard than you would get in downtowns, which are actually public space.
Talking to Alexandra Lang about her new book, Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have fond or less than fond memories of spending time at a mall? Did you go to them a lot in their heyday? Do you still go to your local community shopping mall? If not, what replaced it to meet your shopping needs? Do you miss anything about having a place with a, I don't know, big fountain in it and all the mall-like amenities? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexandra, malls were super successful, right, for a long time. Can you talk about malls at their peak?
Malls at their peak, they were building basically hundreds of malls per year because every suburb needed one. And during the time when they were at their peak, people did a lot of really kind of fun and innovative things with them. I think the innovation that most people are familiar with is the Mall of America, which put an entire roller coaster in the center of the mall. You know, no fountain, but a roller coaster. So there was this sense that malls had to kind of top themselves and that they were also competing in the fashion marketplace for the newer, better, you know, kind of more technologically advanced mall. And that's a really fun period to study, basically, you know, leading through the 80s and into the early 90s.
I listed a few causes of a decline for malls, and we've seen that in a lot of places around the country. One was, you write, they just built a lot of malls, maybe too many malls. How did we end up with a glut?
Well, the short answer to that is capitalism. Basically, mall developers saw where a mall had been successful but was maybe getting a little tired looking and just built a new mall 10 miles away in a fresher suburb and sucked all of the business from that older mall to the newer mall rather than building one in a place that hadn't had a mall. So then you get two malls, one's doing well, one's on a slow decline, and may eventually die. So I think that over competition and kind of lack of imagination and where to open new malls really doomed a lot of them.
Talking to Alexandra Lang, design critic. Her new book is Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. We're looking at malls past, present, and future. And yes, she says there is a future. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is in store for the future of American shopping malls? Maybe they look different now, laid out differently. We'll get into that in just a bit. Are you now or have you ever been a mall shopper or have you worked at malls? Do you have an experience you would like to share? Do you have a question about how they've changed over the years? And hey, do you have a mall that is unused or disused in your community? What would you like to see happen to it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about shopping malls, their history, their design, their future. Alexandra Lang is with us, a design critic. Her new book is called Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you go to malls in your heyday? Did you make plans to meet someone by the fountain or the food court or you name it? Are malls part of the distant past for you or part of the present in how and where you shop? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexandra, one key point I take away from your book is, yeah, we might keep saying malls are dead or dying. Malls are not dead, and they're not necessarily dying. Why? Make the case for us.
Well, some malls are dying, but even the most doomsday predictions by retail experts still indicate that there are probably going to be 700 to 800 healthy malls in the U.S., which still seems like a heck of a to me. Those malls tend to be like newer malls, malls with higher end department stores, and those have really held on to their customer base and are still offering something that people want. I think the dead mall narrative was really spurred by a lot of actually often very beautiful photography of dead malls that went viral, and people just kind of extrapolated from that and were like, okay, malls are over.
We heard from Ravana on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who says they always hated the mall, but sometimes when they went to their local one, there was a survey company in it. Ravana learned to spot the surveyors to participate in surveys, be sure to walk by them so they could take a survey and get cash or coupons for the food court. Says made having to be in the mall a little better. I got, I know I did a soda challenge at a mall one time. I intentionally picked the wrong one and I didn't get the free soda. I was just being ornery. But Alexandra, you know, that reminds me, like, the question of whether a mall is a public space. A survey company might set up shop there. Can protesters set up shop at a mall? Can, you know, is this really a public sphere we can go into and interact with people? Has been a question over the years.
It has. And that the answer to that question actually varies state by state. The first legal case around whether a mall was public space and could be used for public protest actually occurred in 1968. And Thurgood Marshall wrote the opinion, the majority opinion, and said that malls should be available for protest because they were becoming the new main street. Now, over the years, that right has been whittled away, and now it really depends where you're located whether or not you can protest at the mall.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. KB is with us in La Crosse. KB, hello.
Hey, good afternoon, guys.
What did you want to tell us about?
Hey, I just wanted to mention I, in a previous life, worked in Rosedale Mall up in Roseville, Minnesota, and it was a blast. I actually love that job because of the network of other employees and other shops. It got to the point where we'd all make friends with each other and stuff and offer each other our employee discounts, kind of like a whole barter system kind of thing. You know, I worked in a record shop and CDs and video games and stuff, and, you know, there'd be the girl down the hall who worked in a hair salon, and she'd do my hair, and I'd give her my employee discount for her CD that she wanted, you know, so David Bowie specifically, you know, kind of thing. You know, it's kind of cool.
KB, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. I worked in a mall for some years, and I got pretty good deals on some Sbarro's breadsticks, not going to lie. Alexandra, the people who work at malls, a community, KB says. I don't know if you'd looked at the mall workers that much, but it's a unique kind of place to work.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of stories like that, often from people that were hanging out at malls anyway as teens and then thought, hey, I should get a job here too. But I think that's a great kind of tribute to the fact that the mall can be a community space. Yes, we tend to focus more on the consumers, but having all of those businesses in proximity is part of what makes malls great. And the workers are really just taking advantage of the same kind of proximities as customers are.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Alexandra Lang. Her new book is called Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. Alexandra, maybe my favorite chapter was your last one. I think of malls as American. And not so much anymore. You surveyed some malls around the world, and they're kind of taking us to mall school.
They are. One of my favorite examples in that chapter is from the Philippines, where the malls are all basically the same size as the Mall of America. And they are very often on light rail lines. They will have government offices in them. They're basically like satellite cities all under one roof. And I think, especially if we're going to try to densify cities and inner ring suburbs, thinking of the mall as something that can truly be an urban hub is a great way to go. But it would require us sort of like opening our eyes to what's happening elsewhere in the world with malls.
And one interesting bit of motivation, I think it was Chile, you gave an example where if I own a mall, I can get a pretty good tax break if I host a museum or a library or other public institution.
Exactly. That is true in Chile. And actually, it's also true in the U.S. I got a message from a public library in Maryland that is located in the mall. They started as just a kind of like check-in, check-out mini branch. And the mall said, oh, you're doing so well. Like, let's give you 30,000 square feet. And now it's one of the most popular branches in the county.
I want to look at some of the ways malls or the spaces they are on are changing. I've seen a lot of malls around the state here go from the all indoor enclosed to doing some redesign and, you know, having an outdoor street and you enter the buildings from outside. So outdoorizing these indoor malls. Is that a trend everywhere in the country?
That is a trend everywhere in the country. It's generally, you know, more popular in the South and in California, where the weather is nicer year-round. But that is definitely a trend. I also think, something that's really important is there's been the demise of a lot of department stores. And so as malls try to reposition themselves, coming up with other uses for those department store spaces, things that people really do want to leave their house for, is super important. And some of the most important things in those categories that I've seen are food, you know, food halls, food marketplaces, and also kind of family fun like trampoline parks.
And another change that seems to be going on, grocery stores are part of malls more and more now, you write, but also malls, including on their grounds, residential stuff, maybe upstairs or maybe on the outskirts.
Yeah, a lot of people are suddenly realizing that malls have way too much parking. And what can we do with especially the parking lots around the edges of the malls where maybe we want to start making nicer, more pedestrian streets? And those are really ripe for building housing, especially kind of townhouses, low-rise apartment buildings in places that really need to build more residential.
We heard from Charlie in Eau Claire who couldn't stay on the line. Charlie grew up in the 70s. She says the name of the book is fantastic. Threw her right back into her childhood. Charlie remembers going to Hot Sam's and Orange Julius to eat with friends. Yeah, when you started thinking, should I write a book about malls? People were very quick to share their mall memories with you, right?
Yeah, and as an architecture critic, like, I want to write about things, buildings, designs that people have feelings about. And so malls just felt like this great untapped resource that, oh, people love this architecture, even if they've never thought about it as architecture.
You mentioned untapped resources, and you write about malls that are more or less completely defunct, actually being potentially great opportunities to use that land, but in different ways. What kind of things are you seeing?
Well, one of my favorite examples is Austin Community College, their Highland campus in Texas, where an entire community college moved into a defunct mall. And they have built new residential housing in the parking lots. And they actually now have enough space so that they've invited the local public TV station to have their offices, you know, in one of the former department stores. And so it's becoming this whole mixed-use community and a center for students when before it was just this big dead mall.
What are you watching for? Now, I mentioned the glut of malls. There's also big box stores challenging them, internet shopping, the pandemic, and more. What are some of the big trends you're watching for now in 2022 when it comes to the malls you've been researching for so long?
I think The major trend is that kind of mixed-use redevelopment, saying, okay, like, we still want to have retail here. People, you know where it is, know what to shop for here. But what else can we do with the parking lot? What other kinds of things can we invite into this space, whether those are medical facilities or churches or kind of the upscale supermarkets that you can eat in, that will really bring people out of their houses and allow them to kind of get together in an air-conditioned space, a space with a fountain, a space maybe with indoor plants.
And one thing that struck me, it seems like nowadays mall, for people who are building malls, may be a four-letter word. It seems like some of the people you want to talk to want to call their thing anything but mall.
That is so true. Let's see, what did they try to tell me? They called it a vertical retail center. They called it like a piazza. They called it a marketplace. But I just felt like people know what a mall is. Like when I say mall, you know what I'm talking about. And if I say vertical retail center, it's like, what?
Alexandra, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Alexandra Lang is a design critic. She joins us today for a look at her new book. It's called Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. Still time for you to share your mall memories, if any, whether they go back 3 decades or 3 minutes. Let us know what you think about malls, past, present, and future. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And hey, if you have a building that we would typically have called a mall in years past that's getting used differently now, where some of the space is getting used in a different way than straight up retail, love to hear about that too. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up after the news, what fresh summer vegetables do you look forward to the most? A chef talks to us about seasonal eating, what it means, why we might want to give it a try. And you can join us and tell us your favorite things to eat in a Wisconsin summer. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, Wisconsin's Supreme Court said a member of the DNR's policy-setting board can keep his seat despite the fact that his term expired over a year ago. A WPR reporter tells us about the court's decision and what it means. Now it's Food Friday. Summer is a time of fresh fruits and veggies and a great time to eat seasonally. Seasonal eating may not only taste better, it can also be good for our health and the health of the planet. From farmers markets to foraging to gardening, there's a lot of ways to get great local produce. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite produce this time of year? Your favorite fruit or vegetable? Where do you get it? Farmers market? Forage? Your own backyard? What do you like to cook with? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Elena Terry is a chef and Ho-Chunk tribal member. She's the founder and executive director of Wild Bear Ease, a Wisconsin-based nonprofit she started to keep First Nation food traditions alive and to help community members who are dealing with trauma or addiction. Elena, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, I know I've talked to you in the past about seasonal foods, and I know you, like me, are pretty excited about them. Why do you enjoy seasonal cooking and eating so much?
I think here in Wisconsin, we have such a diverse amount of food that changes so significantly with the seasons that it's so nice to be able to get the bounty when it's the freshest as possible. And in summer, I mean, this is a great, very abundant time for us.
What right now is out there in Wisconsin that you're loving to work with?
We just are finishing up the last of the milkweed bud season, and that's for foraging. And that's a really big delicacy for us. And it's something that kind of marks the true beginning of summer when that season shifts. And of course, right now, it's all of these fresh garden ingredients. Like, we started our gardens over a month ago. So now we're starting to see some of those fruits of our labor popping out. And it's just, it's really exciting.
Now, hang on. Milkweed buds are edible by humans? Because I'm a really good milkweed farmer. My strategy is to not pull it up when it grows because it's good for butterflies. I had no idea that these are edible, all of them?
Yeah, the milkweed is a really diverse plant. And the buds, when they're still green and tight before they start turning to the purple color, are edible. So we take the buds and the very immature leaves that surround those. And yeah, we've done everything with them, from tempura and frying them to putting them in our traditional soup.
Wow. Okay. Well, you've just blown my mind right off the bat there. What are some other things that people are surprised to learn that is, you know, maybe right in our backyard and edible?
I mean, there's so much in our backyards. One of the things that I like to show, especially the youth that we work with, are the red clovers. That it's one of those things that you see and you don't really process, that it has this incredibly sweet floral honey flavor to it. And so we like to mix that with, say, lemonade to give it a completely different twist and to add a little bit of a color to something. And it just, I think it brightens up your palate a little bit in identifying that there's those flavors out there in these incredible plants. You know, we also talk about dandelions a lot, but the incredible health benefits to those. And it's a plant that we walk past and we don't really see unless you're looking for it. I think right now, even the blueberries are coming out. And I mean, it's a very plentiful time for us.
Other berries are out there now, too. I've talked to you in the past, I think, about service berries, a.k.a. June berries. They have a bunch of different names. I've been making simple syrup out of them, and I froze some for smoothies. What are some of your favorite berries that you like to work with this time of year?
Oh, my gosh. Every berry. We're the wild berries. No. First of all, I love hearing that you have made stuff out of them. You know, this year was the first year that I even tried making some lilac syrup, and it was incredible because then I used that syrup to make marshmallows and to put in like into a cake. So I think when you see these berries, that transition, when you're able to get out and pick them, you're able to really open up a plethora of different ways to utilize them, right? You don't just have to make a syrup. You could even add, if you were making the syrup, you could add that into your favorite cocktail or drink to really boost the flavor. And it's not just the berries themselves. A lot of the times you can harvest different flowers from them and use that to incorporate it into flavoring your food. So, I mean, we just got a ton of mulberries off the trees and we made that into jam. I think the biggest thing with those is that they are very seedy. So if you need to strain them a couple times, we do that just to alleviate some of the extra texture that might be in there. We're just now starting to see the berries come out on our blackberry bushes in the backyard. So I'm really excited for those to come. And like I said, the wild blueberries are incredible. If you are able to find a patch of wild blueberries, they're so much more condensed when it comes to sweetness and flavor. It's definitely something different from what you would be able to purchase off the store. Although buying blueberries at the store isn't always terrible either.
Now, for general foraging advice, for people who didn't grow up knowing what is edible and what isn't, what is your advice to make sure we're eating stuff that that is edible?
Yeah, of course. And there is a lot of like doppelgangers and tricky parallel plants. So you want to make sure that what you're foraging, you're aware that it is what you hope. There's a lot of apps out nowadays where you can for free identify plants. And then there's some where you can pay a little extra and they'll give you all of the information, like the Latin terminology of the plant, if it's toxic or what its multiple uses could be. So I always say, if you're not familiar with it, definitely we have the resources nowadays where it's like, before I used to have my pocket identifier book on me all the time. And now it's a little bit easier because I can just pull out my phone and see to confirm. And even with me, I do that just to make sure when I'm foraging that I'm getting the right thing, because the last thing we want to do is to take something that isn't meant for us to take, whether that's an edible food or plant or for medicinal purposes. However, if you do really want to get a little bit more in depth from what like a snapshot on an app could give you, I would say find the plant and then do a little bit deeper research. When it comes to milkweed, if you look it up, it says it's a toxic plant, and it is at different phases of the plant's lifespan, but every part of that plant is usable at some phase of its life, and it doesn't really say that on the internet. So I would say do a little deeper research if it's something that you've heard about, or, you know, just to confirm whether or not it is toxic, because some of those things might say eat it and it isn't edible, or it's based on the phase that it's at in its growth.
We're talking to Elena Terry, a chef and executive director and founder of the group Wild Bear Ease. That's B-E-A-R-I-E-S, like Bear Ease. It is Food Friday, and we're talking about eating with the seasons, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite food to forage in a Wisconsin summertime? Do you have a favorite crop that you like to eat this time of year? Something maybe popping up in your garden or at your local farmer's market? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Elena, we've been focusing on foraged food items so far. What are some of your favorite cultivated things that are popping up this time of year that you like to work with?
Oh, so we have lavender that we cultivate, and those flowers right now are incredible. And this year we've been focusing on pole beans. So they are really climbing and stretching out, but we haven't seen any of those come yet. We have planted a lot of different squash, and although we haven't seen the fruits appear, we have been able to harvest the male squash blossoms and use those, which is an incredible vessel for any kind of, it's so versatile. We really like to stuff it with cheese and then like roll it in some blue cornmeal and deep fry that. And it's this incredible crispy texture with a creamy inside. I mean, you know, in Wisconsin, I love cheese and I like to stuff it into stuff. Those squash blossoms are, if you have access to them, I would definitely say to try it, because it's very unique when it comes to texture and flavor, and it's really hearty, but it's also very delicate. So that's one of my favorite things to get out of the garden now too, is our harvesting those things that help us be responsible with the plants as well.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Matthew is with us in Blue Mounds. Matthew, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. A couple of things that I've been doing for years is the harvesting of the wild mushrooms, the chanterelles, the hen in the woods. Now the oyster mushrooms are still pretty prevalent, and then the chicken in the woods. And they're just out there ready to be taken and, put in your culinary ideas.
And Matthew, what do you like to do with them cooking-wise?
Well, we just discovered a new thing with the oyster mushrooms. We actually just leave the caps, and we do them on a sheet pan with oil, and we crisp them up, and they're almost like potato chips.
Oh, wow. Oven-roasted mushroom chips. I love it, Matthew. Thanks a lot. Elena, your thoughts on mushrooms?
Oh, my gosh. I love that, Matthew. Thank you for sharing that. I mean, mushrooms are incredible, and he lives in the perfect spot to go foraging for them. They are a little tricky, so it's something that you want to be able to make sure that you're identifying correctly.
Right.
And sometimes they say a cross cut will help you do that if you slice them open. But once you find what you're looking for, like, mushrooms add this incredible depth of flavor to anything you put them in. Sometimes they can be a little bit overpowering, so you have to like that flavor or get a little bit more accustomed to it. But when you add them, I mean, they're not just flavor. You can change the texture of a dish. I mean, they're incredible. I love hearing about people who are able to go into the woods and identify all the different kinds of mushrooms and find them. Those are my kinds of people.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Elena Terry, chef, founder and executive director of Wild Berries. Elena's with us to talk about cooking with the seasons, including foraging and some great things to try in the summer months. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite bit of produce available in Wisconsin this time of year? Whether it's wild foraged or grown, let us know what you like to do with it, where you get it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Elena Terry, a chef, founder, and executive director of Wild Berries, a Wisconsin-based nonprofit. Elena is joining us to talk about the many benefits of eating with the seasons, talking about some great gardened and foraged foods we can eat here in Wisconsin this time of year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Elena, I want to follow up. I got the zucchini in the backyard. I got the flowers. I'd like to eat them, but I don't want to eat them if it's going to stop the zucchinis from growing. You mentioned the male blossoms. I don't know how to tell them apart.
Well, the males have a pistil inside. So they definitely look a little bit different, and you want to keep the female ones to get pollinated, and those will turn into the fruit. So if they have like the really long stem inside, those are the male ones.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Andrea is with us in Shorewood. Andrea, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
So in my garden, I love the early harvest. So if I have like young spring spinach and beet greens, if I grow too many beets, but I love my foraging is, and I only pick it out of the garden, is actually a weed, but in my mind, it's highly edible and delicious. It's called purslane, and it has a lemony citrus flavor to it. I only pick it early in the season when it is, before it's gone to seed or anything, but when my young greens are coming up. To saute it in a pan is just this, it adds this vibrant lemony citrusy flavor, and it's kind of looks like a little bit of a succulent, but you can't mistake it for anything, and it's never poisonous.
Andrea, thanks a lot for sharing that. I have a purslane story. I had a patch in my yard. I was going to try to grow grass in it, and all this weed took it over, and I was yanking it, and a woman in the neighborhood came by. I was like, what are you doing? Why are you throwing all that away? And she told me it was purslane, and I told her she could take all of it she wanted to. Elena, have you worked with purslane?
Yes, and it's a great ingredient, and it is pretty prolific in gardens. So if you have access to it, like it does have a very unique taste and flavor, and it does offer some brightness. I was going to say also, you know, an incredible way to appreciate your early greens and the freshness of the beginning of this season is to make a salad. I mean, I know it sounds really basic, but you can transform the flavors of a salad so significantly with what you choose to put in there and how you choose to dress it. And when you were talking about making simple syrup, that's a great way to infuse flavor into a very easy vinaigrette. So I definitely appreciate being able to do that and load up whatever's fresh and harvestable on that day into those salads.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Andrea, at 800-642-1234. Brian joins us now in Kenosha. Brian, hi.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, Brian?
Oh, I want to talk about how much I'm looking forward to harvesting the wild black caps that are going to be coming up in our area shortly. So that's I think it's either an invasive or a native black raspberry that's growing in our area.
Okay, and then what do you do? I mean, obviously you could just eat them, but what do you do with all of them?
Well, either freeze them to preserve them for the rest of the season, or I'll make a big batch of jam and can that up. There's a bunch of different things that you could do with them. I make a really nice black raspberry salad dressing out of them. Ooh. But that's just one of my all-time favorite fruits that grows wild in this area. But there's also, we just passed the wild asparagus season, and that's one of my all-time favorite moments. Like right around Mother's Day in this area is when it popped up in all the bike trails and drain ditches by fields.
Wow. Brian, thanks a lot. So, Elena, those black cap raspberries he's picking.
Oh my gosh, those are absolutely delicious. I mean, just saying black cap raspberry, it reminds me of being a kid and finding these wild bushes when we were out swimming or something. And it was like the mother lode. They're really sweet and very condensed flavor. I think the best way to honor it is to add a little bit of that acid again, like a little bit of fresh lemon juice as well. I think sometimes when I've frozen them, they've gotten a little bit mustier flavor, like they deepen in their flavor. So that might be something to look out for. But I think when it comes to those, I barely get them to the freezer because they're so delicious. We'll just leave a bowl of them on the counter and my kids will eat them throughout the day.
Brian, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Elena Terry on Food Friday. Elena, what are you looking forward to now in the next couple months? Let's advance the clock a little bit. What are you watching for to pop up?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I mean, I love the corn season when fresh corn starts coming and showing up in different forms, if it is a colored corn or the sweet corn. I mean, it's just something that really comes out is summertime for me when the corn starts to be, you know, taller and plentiful. And of course, I love the squash. I know that we had mentioned beets before, and I really think beets are an underappreciated, just like golden egg that grows. You know, they're so good for you and they're very versatile. And at first I was a little intimidated by the earthy flavor of that. But I think roasting a beet with a little bit of orange juice and olive oil is incredible. They're almost like little sugar cubes of a very unique flavor. And you can eat the greens on those and saute them, which kind of brings me to this very prolific space of like collard greens and the incredible greens that come out. And they are so plentiful in the summer. You can complement those greens on any level with your fresh herbs. And making sure that you are able to honor that. I mean, the other day we had some early potatoes with just fresh dill, and it was an incredible bite. I made it again the next day. It was so good. So I think just being able to be open, and I myself love finding new foods and trying them out and seeing what people are growing. So being able to go to the farmer's market or to be in community like that, where people have really put something, an investment into cultivating these foods, I think those foods just have a brighter flavor and a bigger appreciation in your household when you are able to use them. So definitely, it's a very plentiful time of year, and there's a lot of diversity in our communities with what's provided. I mean, I just can't wait to see what people come up with.
Now, with corn, I got to say, I love fresh corn. I've never been really creative with it in the past. Boil it and eat it, or grill it and eat it. But lately I've started, you know, maybe roasting it and using it for a Mexican street corn, or, you know, just getting creative ways to get different flavors out of it. What is your favorite thing to do with the fresh corn?
Well, when you talk about flavor diversification or using it a little bit differently, you can grate a fresh ear of corn and it gets that corn milky, incredible. Like if you had a creamed corn, you can add that to anything. Like I use that for bread. I use that and strain it to add flavor to stock, which you can also take like your corn cob and add that to a soup stock. And it is just incredible when you include that part of the corn in, which I think a lot of people discard. I used to discard it until I found out how flavorful it was when you added it to another dish.
I'm grating the actual cob into my soup. I want to make sure I'm hearing you right. The cob itself.
Yes, yeah, wow. The cob. It try it and then we'll talk again because it's transformative. It really is a different depth of flavor and it contributes so much to the end result. I think just being able to open your mind and be willing to try different techniques with it is incredible. I mean, the corn fritter, the hush puppy, there's so much that we can talk about corn. What are you doing next week?
Let's have you back when corn is really in season. That sounds awesome.
I would love to talk corn with you.
I'm in. We'll get it on the calendar. Elena, thanks again for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
That's Elena Terry, a chef, Ho-Chunk tribal member, and founder and executive director of the group Wild Berries, a nonprofit here in Wisconsin. She started in part to help keep First Nation food traditions alive. She joined us to talk about seasonal eating, what produce you can expect to find in Wisconsin this time of year and the weeks to come, grown and foraged as well. Keep sharing your favorites over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, insects are keys to ecosystems, agriculture, and more, but there are some signs of declining populations. Check out the research and conservation efforts. That's Monday morning on the Ideas Network. Paleontologists in Wyoming, Nebraska, and South Dakota have been finding a bounty of interesting fossils in recent years, with lots of smaller specimens with the help of some very helpful research assistants who sometimes bite the researchers. As reported in the New York Times science section, species of harvester ants build large mounds, bigger than your average anthill. They line the outside of them with larger chunks of material that might mean rocks, but can also include fossils, including teeth and jawbones of small mammals, in some cases 30 million years old. And they dig 6 feet underground to pull up that material, which saves the scientists a lot of digging. The ant assistants have helped discover new species from the past, including a tiny mouse, early relatives of modern beavers, and more. Scientists are repaying the favor by naming some of the species after the ants. I don't think the ants care. Just one downside to harvester ants, according to one of the researchers, they're not fantastic when they're biting you. We've got friends in low places. This is Central Time.